You're listening to Psych Talk.
You're listening to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carborough. This is your voice in the community, and everything here is volunteer-powered and volunteer-run. Right now, you're listening to Psych Talk on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., and on Psych Talk, we look at questions related to psychology, to neuroscience, to the social sciences. And today we're focusing on sociology and also the guest behind the sociology. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Karen Glum. So she's a sociologist and a teacher at the North Carolina School of Science and Math, or NCSSM. So that's how we'll be referring to it. NCSSM is a two-year public boarding school that accepts juniors across North Carolina through merit-based applications. But now back to Dr. Glum. She has an MA in sociology from Eastern Illinois University and a PhD also in sociology from the University of Texas, Austin. She's the author of a 2007 memoir titled Releasing an Imprisoned Spirit, Removing the Seizure Focal Point. She'll tell us about her epilepsy and how it's played a complex role in her life, especially since it went undiagnosed for decades. So we've got a couple pieces here. We've got the memoir and the issues related to her personal life there. We've got the school that she's teaching at, which is unique in its own right and interesting to talk about, NCSSM, or the North Carolina School of Science and Math. And finally, we've got sociology and the work that Dr. Glum has done in that area. So we're going to start with the last thing I mentioned, actually, with the sociology. First, Dr. Glum, if you want to say hi to the listeners.
Hey, everybody. Nice to be here on your radio station today. Nice to see Jose again.
Thanks for coming on. Yeah, full disclosure, I went to NCSSM and I took a class with Dr. Glum, so I knew in advance that this would be a great interview. Tell us about your graduate work. We'll get to school later, but your work for your master's degree and then for your PhD, you worked on various projects and research classes for your thesis and dissertation. Give us a sort of a little survey of different types of things you worked on.
Okay, I think certainly when you're studying sociology, you're studying society. Very broad. So you try to pick your niche in terms of that. For my master's program, this was a research course. We can pretty much pick the topic. And I was very interested in a cult that was active on my campus. I had heard rumors of it. We're a relatively small campus, about 10,000 students nestled in a small community of 20,000. But here was a church that had about 250 members, all students. No other church in town had very many members, more than 40. So I was interested in that. Well, the minister thought that he was the new Jesus Christ. At least that's the rumors I heard on the streets. So I wanted, that was going to be my research project for that year. I wanted to get inside the church and find out what was going on. And it was fascinating. There were basically two men that were in charge. Roger Lamb, that we think changed his name. We don't think he was born Roger Lamb. He thought he was the new Jesus Christ. And then there was Kit McKean, that was his assistant, that did. Kit McKean was the big guy that was supposed to be bringing in a lot of people. So I did tell them I was interested in the church, and of course they want you to join. And they never specifically told me that they had a new Jesus Christ. They won't tell you unless you join. But I did catch it from other people who had left the church, and it wasn't easy for them to get out. So most of them changed their names. They didn't want anyone to know where they were living. So many of them, they only would interview me, let me interview them if they knew that I was bringing no one else with me. We were out someone where no one could follow them or me. So they were still real nervous about what was going to happen. And I found out that Roger Lamb thought he was the new Jesus Christ and that they had to join the church to get to heaven. And anyone that didn't join the church was going to go to hell. So he was able to convince those members. And so your goal is to get me in the church. Because otherwise I'm going to go to hell. So that's your responsibility. You're saving my life. So that was an interesting experience to...
Quick point about the first stages when you were first hearing about it. You were hearing rumors or rustles while you were trying to find a project to work on. How much detail did you get? It sounds like you already sort of heard someone spill the beans that the leader thought he was Jesus Christ. What else did you hear about?
I heard it in the dorms. I remember it was our resident assistant when I was moving into the dorms that said, be careful. There are some members from Heritage Chapel that are looking for you to join their church. They're not going to tell you who they are. They're going to invite you to their dorm room for free food. Just be careful and don't go anywhere you don't want to go and let me know if you're uncomfortable. So that's the first thing I heard from the RA when I was moving into the dorm. And she said, what the place is called is Heritage Chapel, but they won't tell you that when they say they're taking you out to dinner. And Heritage Chapel was off campus, so you might not know like how to get back to the dorm if they drove you. So that's the first I heard. Then I went through student newspapers, and there had been some write-ups warning students about Roger Lamb, Kit McKean, and Heritage Chapel. And the Church of Christ threw Heritage Chapel out. They used to be a Church of Christ, and once Roger Lamb and Kit McKean got there, they couldn't be a Church of Christ anymore. So that was all in the newspapers.
Wow. So it sounds like they had different mechanisms for attracting recruits. First, they just
lie to you.
They attract you with free food.
Right.
And at a certain point, you start hearing some scary ideology or some almost like veiled threats about what's going to happen to you if you don't join. And there must have been money involved with joining, right?
Well, yes. Certainly, when you start joining, they want you to give all you can to the church. Because once again, their whole goal is to get to many people to heaven as possible, so they need money. I did talk to a few people that had – I talked to a mother whose son actually had written – he had a huge chunk of money for college that he gave to the church. So he had to drop out of school. And then there were other people that sold homes and gave the money to the church, thinking that that was going to be their way to get to heaven. And, of course, they wanted me to give money, but I was poor at the time, and what money I had was not going to go to the church, which is why I didn't get into the full-blown recruitment. I stayed on the outside watching and talking to. But most of the people I talked to who had left the church had lost all their money, whatever money they had. The longer you stay in, the more you're supposed to give, which means they go out and try to get money, you know, from other locations. Take a second job. And then turn the money into the church, things of
that
nature.
That's incredible. Well, here we are in 2011. I'm assuming that Harris Chapel has morphed or dissipated. Have you kept track?
Yes, as much as I could. Basically, the church itself was burned down. They were asked by Charleston, Illinois, to leave. So certainly the community came in. Roger Lamb, I don't know where he went, but Kit McKean is still out there. If you guys go into the internet, type in Kit McKean, he's out there. I can't remember which state, and I don't think it's far from here, frankly. I think it's somewhere in this area. So he did move on, and of course he's at a church with a strange name, and he doesn't say he's Jesus Christ, but I question it. But,
sounds so ominous when you say he's out there.
Yeah, I know. Like, where is he? He's looking for me. I know it. Yeah.
So I want to talk about how sociology helped you frame what you were doing with the Harris Chapel, how it helped you frame questions and approach them in a somewhat rigorous or structured way.
Well, once again, the generally sociology studies society, but its big thing is studying, also studying socialization and also studying the impression of others around us. So basically, sociology is very different from psychology. Psychology focuses on who we are internally. Now, we might be influenced from the outside society, but sociology has trouble with that. Sociology says we can't know who you really are without recognizing all the people that have been around you. So in looking at Harris Chapel, one of my main goals in terms of sociology was, who would join this church? Why would they? What was about them that made them more likely to join? Why was I so opposed to, you know, what was it about me that made me not want to join, but others were very willing to? And it seemed the common denominator would be they were loners. They needed friends, and they got an instant 250. But they only liked them as long as they gave to the church. And that's what those people that dropped out said. I felt loved until I was questioning some of the practices, and then all of a sudden I was hated. Right. So those are the things of sociology that wants to study relationships, the impression of the outside world in terms of how we grow and how we act differently in different settings.
That's interesting. Well, you identify this one factor of being lonely or a loner as the key thing that drives people to, or that drove people to Harris Chapel. And that sounds, at some level, like sort of psychological, right? In that it could be a trait of theirs, and this trait leads them to manifest behaviors. But at the same time, there needed to be the chapel there with its own recruitment methods in order for them to end up in that situation where they're selling
their homes.
And
those recruitment methods, and know how to find them in groups. You know, they knew how to find these loners in groups. Certainly, that's where psychology would come in. Were they born loners? And sociology would say, I can't answer that. I don't know. I know now what this person in 18, 19, 20, 21 is a loner, mm-hmm. looking for a place to belong.
Right.
I didn't see too many connections in family. You know, when I did ask those that left the church, I didn't see that they have felt neglect from their childhood. They just felt that here they are on a college campus. They were one guy said, I wanted to go there for the free food. You know, and I mean, he was not a loner. I mean, but he found himself comfortable there before he knew. I mean, I think it typically was about 3 months before they would find out that Roger Lamb thought he was new Jesus. Mm. So you have to be full blown into the church and sign over everything before you say, this is the new Jesus Christ. You will be going to heaven since you remember. So.
Well, you know, I reflect, 3 months doesn't even sound like as long as they could have drawn it out. I think other religious groups can take a much longer time with many more steps to reveal their secrets. And I'm thinking of Scientology in the back of my mind.
Ah.
But that leads to this broader question, how we should classify different religious groups, and one word that gets thrown around with sometimes a pejorative spin is the word cult.
Yeah.
So tell us what you think a cult is from a sociological perspective, and then how that ties into the Harris Chapel.
And certainly you'll probably find different philosophies, but the main way I looked at it is the new leader thought he was the new Jesus Christ. That's the first characteristic. Number two, they don't use the Old Testament at all. They only use the New Testament. So those are the two key things that I saw in a cult. And then number three, the next key thing is that only the people in that group will go to heaven. The rest of us go to hell. So those are the three key characteristics that I used to separate that particular church from Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutherans, Catholicism, whatever. I saw that as a distinct difference. Now, we certainly do have some other spinoffs, you know, of smaller religious groups, but I still saw the consistency in those small groups is that they did accept the Old Testament, and they did not believe that their leader was the new Jesus Christ, and that they didn't believe you're going to go to hell if you were not in the church. Now, certainly we hear of things in other worlds now, other countries, where they do have these types of religious organizations where you have to die. You know, you will die if you're not in the church, so it's not unique to the United States.
Right. Well, you're mentioning other countries, and I'm wondering about the portability of these criteria, because if we move outside of Christian or maybe even Abrahamic religions, then it's a little harder to find the equivalent of Jesus Christ. I guess you could just say the cult leader needs to think they're some kind of supreme being.
Right, and they're the only one. Right. That there are no others, and that they surpass all of the human characteristics. So they believe they have something superhuman, and they're the only one. What we do know in sociology is that religion has been a basis of society from the onset of time. So the further back we go with it, every culture has had a religion. Not that all members of that culture are involved in those churches, but every single church or every single society from the onset of time has had religion. So a belief that there's a hope when life is over, but most countries don't accept the idea that future is right here today. That's been the cultic part, where that new leader is right here today. Mm-hmm. Even those that believe in Jesus don't believe he's back yet. I guess some people still have the hope he'll come back. We don't know. But most of the churches don't believe. So it's always those outsiders that say they've got the new, whatever that higher power is in any religion, there are some places that think he's on earth today.
So it seems like by your definition, a lot of the founding stages of religions are cult-like. Like when Jesus was actually around, we sort of assume he was in some form related to the Bible, then, and he said, I'm Jesus Christ.
Right, well, he was killed for it, yeah.
Right, then in some sense, you're saying Christianity started out as a cult that organized itself into some more mainstream religion. Does that, am I twisting your words?
Well, you're actually taking a little bit out of my league. You know, you'd have to talk to someone that's more of a major in religion. I mean, I know religion's been around from the onset of time, and there's always been religions that have been accepted and ousted by a society, and those have changed. You know, there's a lot of religions now we accept in the United States that we might not have several generations ago. But once again, I always separated the cult. They didn't go along with the consistency of broader society. The Lutherans do believe in democracy. A cult does not.
Right.
You know.
Okay, well, that's the Harris Chapel, but that's not the only thing you worked on. You were telling me off air about some research into bureaucracy at psychiatric hospitals and what people say when they answer the phone and how it ties into seemingly irrelevant questions like whether a person is insured, and financial questions. So maybe tell us a little bit more about that work.
This was ended up being my dissertation, and it was going on in Texas at the time. What had happened as a boy, he was about 9 years old, was playing a joke on his older brother. A commercial came on TV saying, if you are suicidal, call this number. If you're feeling depressed or suicidal, call this number. And many times they're going to do good therapy. But there are sometimes they're searching to fill beds. This particular time was in San Antonio. Younger brother calls up and says that his older brother is depressed. What happens within an hour is that two police show up at the house to pick up the older brother and to take him to this hospital. And they told the parents. The mother didn't speak much English. So she was trying to understand. And she did not know where her older son was going. And when we did the investigation, they were not two police. They were private security guards from the hospital that was sent there by the doctor that had gotten the phone call from the younger boy. Well, the younger boy finally fessed up, said he was playing a joke on his older brother, and this was the phone number he called. Parents looked for him for 5 days and couldn't find him. They called every hospital in San Antonio, and of course the hospital said, we cannot release that information. Finally, the younger brother called Senator Frank Tejeda, who had talked to his school about issues of call your Senate if you're in trouble. So that little boy called Senator Frank Tejeda, who called every hospital and got a search order to get that kid, the older boy, released. That's what opened up the investigation of all private psych hospitals in Texas to see if they were creating a supply. And typically, now I'm not saying all private hospitals do this, but what I found in a, this was a 3, 6, 8 hearings that took place in Texas, and they were finding a consistency of patients when they called that 1-800 number, they were then immediately, first question, do you have insurance? If the question was yes, please come in for a free interview. You went in for a free interview, they asked for your insurance card, and if you had an insurance card, they found a diagnosis that would fit it and keep you in the hospital until that insurance lapsed. And so we, and they ended up with about 376 patients that came forward, and that was enough for Texas then to put restrictions and have, when you're going into a hospital, you had to have 2 doctors sign, not just one. So several changes took place in the private psych industry as a result of that investigation.
Place this in time for us. I know this is when you're getting your PhD, but we'll get back to the timeline for your own personal life. And so it's, we can start setting some landmarks.
Late 80s up to the mid 90s. I think the investigation was finally closed in 96 when the laws were changed.
Right.
So it took place about 6-7 years. It opened up, I think, in 91 is when the first investigation started.
Right.
And this phone call started in 90. So basically I talked with Frank Tejeda not so long ago, and they were still just keeping an eye on the hospitals. And it spread many states around. California picked it up. Massachusetts picked it up to look at their own hospitals. So I still think even now insurance companies keep a stronger look at psychiatric care.
Right. Well, that's good. There's something nightmarish about the scenarios you're describing, having your child sort of hidden from you.
And they couldn't find it for 5 days. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that boy was waiting for his family to come get him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's another very important project you worked on. I want to jump back to the abstract. We had started to tie in the differences between psychology and sociology.
Right.
Let's look also at subdivisions within sociology, because I think you're especially interested in historical sociology or historical times of sociology. So tell us how you can break down sociology.
Well, yeah, certainly there's several areas of sociology. Basically, you can take you can study medical soci in terms of looking at the reasons why people are ill based on what's happening in society, stress, the way we eat, exercise, things of that nature. Of course, there's organizations, which is kind of was my niche of looking at bureaucracy and organizations. That's where I found the private psych hospitals. Historical sociology is probably relatively new. It would argue that history is not, that what we read in history has to be challenged. Who are the people recording it at that point in time? The further back we go in time, there are people that don't have history, and the first would be the illiterate. And then, of course, women, people of color, and people that were just ostracized by society. So we only get the viewpoint of the wealthy and the literate. So that's what historical sociology is questioning who recorded the events. What was their reason? So certainly when we hear about a war, we don't hear much from the losers. We get the version of the winners.
Right.
So that's historical sociology, is questioning historical events.
Hmm. So I see the value of that questioning, but then how do you get to the next step of determining some truth or accuracy behind the veil and the bias?
What we do, anytime you publish something in probably the social sciences in general, but definitely sociology, you argue, I am basing my conclusions on my research, and I open it up for challenges, because maybe someone else will come up with another angle. Someone could look at my dissertation and say, wait a second, I talked to 1,000 people that were really recovered in private psych hospitals. Well, that's correct. So certainly we argue we have an angle. This is real information. Here's the data. Here's how I got it. But it doesn't mean it's limited only to this. So a good researcher will beat themselves up, because if they don't, the critics will.
Right. Well, one thing that I'm reminded by with this question of picking your own niche and burrowing out like your own pocket of data that you can that's small enough for you to focus on and big enough to tell you something important is the difference between qualitative and quantitative methods. And I think there's a tendency in more qualitative fields to get disdain from the quantitative people who think, well, you're looking at anecdotes and you need to be looking at bigger samples that are controlled and you need experiments or something like, or more longitudinal studies, you know? So how have you encountered that, and what's your thoughts on numbers versus observations and intuitions?
I think all the methods have value. Certainly surveys could tell us a lot. Surveys can tell us a little bit about a lot of people. If I want to know who you're voting for, if I want to know what you do with your free time or where you go, they'll tell us a little bit about a lot of people. But they won't tell us the most in-depth. And they realize that. They know that's their limitation. They just want to find out just the average. But many times we know people lie on surveys. I mean, according to surveys, people only drink about half the alcohol they buy. So who's lying? Is it the alcohol industry? I doubt it, because they got to pay taxes on it. I think people minimize what they say in surveys.
Right.
But it tells us good stuff. We can predict who's going to win the election. We can predict what people are going to buy. You know, retail loves it because they can change stores in terms of that. I respect surveys, but I like to study a lot about a few people. So I wanted to know everything about those 200 or 386 people that got caught up in the hospitals. So that's called qualitative. We learn a lot about a few cases.
Right.
So they're all tell us a lot about society, but everyone has to pick their favorite part.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably get mentally tired doing a survey, but I respect the results that come out of them.
Mm-hmm.
I like to watch people. I go to malls and watch people. You know, that's direct observation, and certainly I like what's called the case study, which is what I did on the hospitals, was a case study of what happened to Texas at that point in time.
Right. So it sounds like you're framing a little bit of a contrast between large-scale, more broad-brush, quantitative surveys where you run the risk of people lying to you. So you sort of, in some sense, wasted your time getting so many people involved because they all were lying.
But we still know stuff.
We still know some stuff. And then when you look at a small group, you learn a lot about those people, but then there's just it's really difficult to extrapolate and figure out what part of those people is representative of the whole society.
And sometimes we have to find a way to do that. One of my colleagues at the University of Texas wanted to study the homeless. So he moved to the streets of Austin and stayed there. He said he admitted he only stayed there as long as he could handle it. And he knew he had a wife to go home to and a home, and the others did not. But he wanted to know what it felt like to be homeless. Now, certainly what David Snow felt in the streets of Austin won't be the same as if he's in New York, but still he can give us a great understanding of what it's like to live, or to hear specifically from a group of homeless what they do. And the main thing he found them doing was sharing, how much they shared and cared for each other to protect them at night. That was the main thing he learned, you know, in living on the streets.
Yeah.
And certainly he knew where he was going. They didn't know where they were going.
Mm.
So all the methods can tell us a lot, but they all have limitations.
Right. And there's something additive that comes out of using methods multiple times or combining methods multiple times, because you have someone maybe who went to Austin and someone who went to New York, and then you can look at both.
Compare them.
Right. So it's helpful.
Consistency, yeah. Mm,
helpful to have people working together.
Right.
Yeah. I'm still thinking about this idea that people lie to you when you ask them from too much of a distance, or you don't really deep dive and you're just looking at big surveys. And I like the example of people drinking half that day. It reminds me of dumpster diving, and I was reading in some Sierra magazine about how the one thing you almost never find that's still somewhat wasted is alcohol. Like if you go to a dumpster, you might find extra bananas, you might find extra grapefruits, but you very rarely find a beer bottle that still
empty.
Has something to drink
in it. Right. Well, it's interesting. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And also the CDC has looked at how many partners men and women claim to have. And somehow men are having more sexual encounters with
their partner than the women admit, yeah.
Right.
So do the men exaggerate because that's cultural, or do women minimize because of cultural patterns? Don't know for sure. The survey gives us good stuff, but we know there's some holes in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump to NCSSM a bit, because you're teaching psychology and sociology at the School of Science and Math here in Durham, North Carolina. We're not in Durham, we're in Chapel Hill, but very close by here in the Research Triangle Park area. So tell us about what this school is like. Give people a picture who maybe never stepped foot in it.
Well, it's residential, and that's a key point. We've got, kids, was about 500 something kids from all over North Carolina. When they arrive on campus, they're moving in as strangers, and that's kind of nice. They all feel that little bit of vulnerability, and then there's the big brother, the seniors that are there to help them move in. So I like that they come from all over the state. The other interesting is that they come in because they want to learn. All of them were bored at their old high school for a variety of reasons, so they come wanting to learn, and this is very new to me. I've always had students that want to learn, but every class had students. When I taught at the college level, all classes had students because their parents were making them. You know, so I always had to keep an eye on them too. But at NCSSM, they all want to learn. That was the consistency, and they all have a high threshold for what they're looking for in the future, and that's exciting because a lot of you, of the generation, I think you're your generation, the younger part, a lot of you guys are scared of the future, but this generation thinks they got the key, or the kids at our school think they got a key, and that's the consistency I'm seeing, is that they see the battles out there in college and the work field, but they think they know some of the numbers and the combination, and they're going to be working on that while they're at the school.
Right. It's interesting you point out the element of choice, that kids could easily stay at their high schools, their public high schools, or even their private high schools nearby at home. There's no special reason they need to go to a magnet school for junior and senior year to live away from home. And in fact, the parents usually pull against that.
Right, they have trouble with it, yeah.
So everyone who's there is not just there because of some social convention the way it might be in college.
Right. Yeah, many of them just were bored at their old school, even to the point where they felt they were smarter than their teachers. I'm getting a consistency, you know, so they really didn't want to talk to their teachers much because they didn't think the teachers could give them much of an answer to some of the questions they had, either about the future or about something in their studies.
And you mentioned that the kids you're seeing at NCSSM are maybe different from their generation in general, and that they really are ambitious and they think they have a way into the future that's not as uncertain. And maybe that has to do with feeling validated because maybe they thought they were smarter than their teachers, and then they get let in and told they're so smart.
Yeah.
I can say from having gone through the experience myself that I didn't see myself as very egotistical. Now, I was a bit put off by how much we were told we were the stars and the best of our schools. And some people, especially it's like my roommate included, just really ate it up. Like, yes, I am a star and I'm among brilliant geniuses. So it can be overdone. But in any case, that seeps into the culture, that exceptionalism.
And I think our classes are on a higher level. And many students get their first B when they take their first tests or quiz at our school, and then all of a sudden they are a little shocked at that. So us as instructors are ready for that because we know they're used to acing everything. They're going to get their first test. I was just giving some stuff in my class, and the students come in, this is the first C I've gotten in my life. Well, then let's talk about that because we want to get you back up to that A level, but you're going to have to change, not my grading strategies.
Right. Yeah, tell us a little bit more about how how students run into more challenge and how they cope with that. It seems like one way of coping with it is just to buckle down and work harder, maybe say something to the teacher, but I'm more interested in the emotions of the students. What mix of emotions do you see as students run into more trouble academically than they expected?
But first of all, I see shock. Some of them pull away, but not for very long. I mean, they'll like go into the state of denial that we talked about in psychology, but many of them are in shock. The very good students will come see us right away. Some students will go to their advisor and as a way of saying, look at this grade I got in psychology and sociology, I'm not used to this. But I think shock is the first one. And then a lot of them will admit that they didn't. So I'll say, let's talk about why you got a C on the test. How much did you study? And they'll admit they didn't study. But then the reason will be I got A's on tests in my old school without studying. Mm. Well, that's not a reason not to study for this one. So the first one is shock, and then they've got then the adjustment. And the students that drop out might not be able to make that adjustment yet. They might not be ready for that level of the work that we give them, because we give them more work than a traditional high school does. Mm-hmm. And they get more work than they will at college. Most students admit when they get to college, I have less homework now than when I took your class. I said, I know, I give you a lot.
Right. And it's interesting, you mentioned some students do drop out, but I put that in air quotes because they switch back to their old high school.
Right. Yeah, they leave our school and go back home. Yeah, sometimes they're just not ready to live in the dorm. Sometimes they're not ready for our level of academia. And sometimes they just miss old friends, parents, having meals that are better than our cafeteria maybe.
Right. All right, well, Dr. Glenn, we're going to keep talking about NCSSM and start focusing in on your particular classrooms and some of the different things you've done, maybe even distance learning, for example. But first, I'm going to fill the listeners in, and we're going to take a quick music break. We've been speaking with Dr. Karen Glum. She's a sociologist and a teacher at the North Carolina School of Science and Math in Durham, North Carolina. When we come back on Psych Talk, we'll be talking more about NCSSM and what it's like to be in a classroom there, comparing it to colleges. And then we'll go into some personal details from Dr. Glum's life that she shared in a memoir and that helped frame some of the academic work we've been talking about. So let's cut to the music and we'll be right back. You're listening to WCOMLP Chapel Hill in Carrboro, and this is Psych Talk, speaking about neuroscience, psychology, and the social sciences every week on Tuesdays, and also online for your listening pleasure. Today we're speaking with Dr. Karen Glum, who's a sociologist and teacher at NCSSM, and we spoke about some of her sociology work with a cult-like church group called Harris Chapel, and also about her look into psychiatric hospitals, private hospitals, and how they're structured, how they approach patients, and maybe some of the issues that were surfacing in the late 80s, early 90s. But now we're going to finish up a discussion about NCSSM as a somewhat unique school, a boarding magnet school funded by the state government, attracting students from all across the state, and just comparing and contrasting it as a model for college preparation versus the usual high school, or even as just an early college experience in some sense. And then we'll get to a memoir that Dr. Glum wrote. So NCSSM, Dr. Glum, tell us about the different classes and academic elements that you've been involved in there. Because I know, for example, there's psychology, there's sociology, there's something called a mini term, there's distance education. So start breaking that down for us.
Well, do understand, I never taught at a traditional high school. I was involved in one as a prevention specialist. Mm-hmm. But definitely we have more elective courses. And frankly, we have elective courses that are taught by people with advanced degrees. I don't know that typical high schools have as many PhDs as we do. So you're really going to get the depth of in the courses. I do remember taking introductory psychology and sociology at my school, and I'm offering more depth because my instructors just had a master's degree. So we offer more depth. We also have them do more reading and college-level books. I don't remember reading very much books. I don't think we were given very many books at my high school. So certainly they're reading college level depth, and many times just, and the mini term gives them a variety of new types of studies where they get to choose something special they want to learn. Distance learning is where we've got our faculty that reach out to communities throughout North Carolina where the kids can't come here for whatever reason. They tried to get in and couldn't because of the number. We can only select so many, or they just don't want to leave home yet, but they can still want to take certain classes that we offer, like psychology, that their own high school doesn't offer.
And then tell us about mini-term. It's this concept that has some parallels in college, but few parallels in usual high schools.
Right. Basically, it's a short course. I have taught several of them, and you get them, you get the kids in the classroom like for 8 hours for, I think it's like 7 school days. Mm. Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
So I'm able to teach, and I ended up teaching medical sociology, and I gave them as much as I could give them at the traditional college semester. So they get absorbed in a topic of their choice. And then some students take trips. They have to have some academia, so they might go to Greece and then study something about the architectural history of the buildings. So they have to have somewhat of an academic angle. But I have had students that wanted to do research, like on music, so they spent mini term doing research on some topic that they're interested in that no course can handle. So they create that, and they find a sponsor that can direct it.
Right, very fun. Let's start, we just compared to the public high school, let's start comparing a little more to colleges and the idea that NCSSM is some kind of early college. I'm interested in the density of the school and how everyone's moving through the same small spaces all the time, almost to the point that I don't know how many students would tolerate the same size campus for college.
Oh, right. I think 2 years is enough. And I also wonder if they can move into a dorm at the college level. I handled the dorm myself in college for 2 years. I wonder, can they handle it 2 years here and then 2 years at UNC? But I think the bonuses we have are really in-depth courses that are college level, but we also have instructors that know they're still teenagers, and when they begin to fall, we have more an eye on them. I give them lots of homework during the trimester. At a college class, if they took psychology with me at college, they might just have three tests, and that's it. So you're not going to know until it's at the end of the semester that you're flunking. My students will know right away, and so will I. So we give them more of the attention you give to a teenager who's adjusting to the adult world, but we also prepare them for the in-depth classes that they're going to get in college without an instructor with an open door policy.
Right. Now, I know that students are bumping into each other all the time in their cafeterias and just in the very small number of spaces they have available. Do you bump into students outside of class, and what's that like?
Yeah, I certainly do. I have a bunch of people that I go out to lunch with. We do need our escape mode, if you call it that. Mm. I love being around the students. I like it's residential. I frankly would not teach at a traditional high school, especially I wouldn't teach psychology or sociology. I like teaching residential. I like that the kids are right next door, but I also need a break. So I take off for an hour and a half for lunch every day to be able to know there's no students around, and we can laugh in our own way, tell our own jokes at the table of adults,
right,
and then go back to be with my kids.
Right, that's good. I'm assuming this is somewhat tangential. You live near campus. It's not like a big commute to work.
Well, actually, I live in Raleigh.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So that's – I had owned the townhome when I got the job, unfortunately. So I could always put it on the market. I keep thinking about it, but the fact of packing up just sounds like too tedious. So I do. I live in Raleigh, so I don't run into the students at the shopping center.
I guess that's just another place where you get your own
alone
time.
Yeah, my own space is 20 miles, yeah, from home.
Right. Okay. And I did like the comment you made about – different dorm environments and how UNC might be different. I'm just going to bounce off of that because I do remember visiting UNC's dorms when I was in my college selection process a few years ago. And I noticed one thing that wouldn't seem strange to most people, but seems strange to me. I was in a bathroom at UNC in one of the dorms, and I was very surprised at how little sense of connection or camaraderie there was between people in the bathroom. And it's a strange thing because everyone's doing their private business in
right.
the bathroom. But at NCSSM, I was so used to people joking around and updating each other and whatever else. Just all kinds of humor and fun added into the bathroom experience. And it was even – some people even commented on that in my – graduation notes on my yearbook, and my mother was very surprised. Like, why are they talking about the bathroom?
Oh, wow.
So anyway, just there are things that NCSSM accustoms you to that aren't actually from high school or college. They're just this microcosm.
Because the school's so small,
right.
The students all know one another, which is good. They can help me learn the names of my students. I'm not good at that. Mm. But it's almost like if a student doesn't go to class, if they're sick, I know they can get the notes. I mean, they just will. They will know who to ask. Or if they're not sure what we're doing in class tomorrow, they know who to ask, and I like that. When I was in college, I do remember myself not knowing all of my dorm mates. So I had my niche of best friends. Here, all the kids know each other, so we do have a sense of intimacy. It's a small campus, so there isn't that much space to roam like in some colleges where, you know, there and my dorm was like a mile from a classroom. That is not true on our campus. So there's a good sense of intimacy, and when there's something going wrong with the students, we'll know well in advance. You might not know that. I do remember hearing of the first hanging at my college when I moved in. I think here we're going to find out if a kid is depressed, you know, quicker than in the college setting, and maybe even the traditional high school, because I think, you know, there's a lot of talking. I do remember my first year here, a kid was dropped out. I was confused, and the two other girls said, oh, we knew she was getting ready to go home. And we told the RLA she was depressed. So that's the better. That's a good part of the intimacy. If there is a problem, we can find out quicker.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're about to jump to the last segment, but is there some final note you want to share with the listeners about NCSSM? Otherwise, you know, we'll...
It's a great place to teach kids. It's been my favorite job. I like teaching them. I like the questions they ask.
How long have you been there now?
This is my ninth year. God, I can't believe it's been 9 years already. Yeah.
Wow. All right, well, there you go. A plug from a teacher and here also corroboration from a student. So let's jump to this last portion. I was really – had invited you on the show to talk business, you know, talk ideas. And I was not aware of your memoir. So it was just a big surprise to me, but also very fitting because on the show we try to not only talk about ideas in the abstract but to apply them in somewhat a grounded and pragmatic way. And for most people – when you're dealing with the social sciences, a really easy way to do that is just to look inward and look at your social circle and look at the life around you. You know, if someone's studying physics, then it's a little harder to tie immediately the abstract ideas in a textbook right. to your life. But the social sciences are just born for that. That's right. where they breathe, you know, and starting to draw on your own experiences. And that's really what you try to do in your memoir. You don't just say, here, I struggled with feelings that went undiagnosed and developed into epilepsy. You try to tie in some of your sociological thinking as you're turning inward. And so that makes it a lot more interesting. And maybe we can recreate that a little bit for the listeners here, but I want to think of this as a story, you know, with a timeline. So rather than sort of give people all the spoilers at the end, let's start with just you growing up and what influences you had and what you're noticing, whatever feels important to you about growing up that would sort of presage who you became, if you want to start from the beginning.
And then we're talking just in the moments I have in general, right? And then also connect them to the epilepsy or all of them epilepsy.
I think it's probably helpful to look at some of the other things aside from epilepsy. Okay. Like you mentioned, for example, that your father was an alcoholic right. and that influenced you. So let's think of this more as a discussion about what's defined you, what's okay. brought you here as Karen Glum, the academic. What led up to that?
Yeah, I do remember my father coming home drunk several times. But I also remember that the number one goal for him was what the family needed. So I do remember that. I know that his drinking was out of control, and I know he tried to hide it. But my mom wouldn't let him, which is atypical. I had friends that had a father as an alcoholic, and they didn't know it. My father didn't really try to hide it, tried to explain it. My mom said, your dad drinks too much. So I do remember that, and I remember the battle between the two of them. And I remember how hard he tried to stop drinking, and he couldn't. And I do remember that a few times when he would try to go dry. And then before he knew it, when he came home, I could tell when he came in the driveway that he had been drinking. So that was my first memory of people trying to quit because his wife asked him to, and he couldn't. So that was a big learning of the power of addiction. Another memory I had is my dad was working in real estate, and this was about the time of the urban sprawl around Chicago. And he had a great job, but he was told by some communities not to sell to people of color, and he wouldn't do it. He said, I can't do that. I'm not going to have a couple that wants to buy a home, and I can't sell it to them because they're not white. Well, my mom, of course, wanted him to do it because she wanted the money, and I just remember the debate, my dad saying, I can't do this. It's wrong. And that's when I think I picked up my drive in sociology to understand racism and discrimination. So that was my passion of that moment. The seizures, I do remember a time. I loved school. I used to just can't wait. My mom said I cried in the summer when school was over. And I remember one day when I came home for lunch and I was really nauseous. And my mom said, well, you must have stomach flu. I think you should go to bed. Don't go to school this afternoon. And then the nausea went away, and I think that was my first seizure.
So that was elementary school?
Elementary school, yeah. I think it was the second or third grade, yeah, that I had the first seizure. That was the first indicator.
And tell us where you grew up. Did you move?
Outside of Chicago.
Outside of Chicago.
Yeah, it was a suburb of Chicago. Mm-hmm. My parents had moved out of Chicago when they got married in order to buy property that was in the suburbs. It was part of the big urban sprawl around Chicago.
And is that where you lived until you went?
Until I went to college, and then until I moved to Texas for a PhD.
Mm. So when you moved to Texas, or did you go to college near Chicago?
No, 200 miles south. So okay. I was in the farm belt.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to get some difference, so I wanted to see what Southern Illinois was like.
So all right. So we've got this point in college where you break out from the home finally, which is probably a big thing. But before we get to that, let's explore a little more before that. So you have a few memories and about epilepsy, but few of them, right?
Very few as a kid. Mm. But it was there. Now that I think back, it really picked up in college when I would start having – I would suddenly feel nauseous. You and I would be talking, and all of a sudden I couldn't understand you. And I would feel nauseous. My blood pressure would go up, so my heart is beating. Might begin to sweat a little. So I went to a doctor. And if you can imagine, a psychologist, when I went there, they were diagnosing me as ADD because I couldn't understand when you were talking. And they wanted me on Ritalin. I'm just like, I'm not ADD. So I just stopped telling people. And so I just said, well, this must be something odd about me. Well, apparently, according to my neurologist today, I was having about 30 to 90 what they are called partial seizures, but they were not diagnosed very easily. You've got to really look for them. You've got to set up to the EEG. The typical EEG is not going to pick up a partial. You got to have the partial seizures, which they're able to do at Duke. They kept me on EEG until I had three partials, and then they found where the focal point was. These were the seizures, their origin is in the brain. It is a seizure. Here it is. Grand mal is going to take over the whole brain. Yes, when the person has convulsions, that takes over the whole brain. They'll be able to pick that up with an EEG very easily. Mine just stayed in this little area of the brain right there. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, you know, so I tried to tell doctors, and they were diagnosing me as ADD, and I knew I wasn't, so I just stopped talking about it. But it does tell me how much I was able to endure a disability. I didn't have the negative side effect of being called disabled. You know, I didn't have that stamp of an epileptic, and I learned how to do chores when I wasn't seizing, you know, so I always got my stuff done early. Because I now never know when that feeling might come.
Right.
So I always turned in things early.
Yeah, you said right there, and you pointed at the left side of your head.
Right,
so it sounds like maybe somewhere like the left temporal lobe.
Yeah. Because I'm right-handed, I was left lobe dominant. So they had to map the left lobe to make sure they didn't touch into the Broca, which is where speech is located.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the dominant lobe. They knew that it was going to be in the left lobe. They wanted it to be far enough away from the seizures. Otherwise, they've done that with people in the past, removed a tumor, and then they ended up touching the Broca. Person can't talk.
Right.
So those are the things they had to make sure since they were in my dominant lobe.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting stories and sometimes tragic stories about surgeries, especially if you go back to earlier in the century where surgeons, you know, it was an experimental procedure. It was a very tough case of epilepsy. And that's how we got, for example, the famous patient HM,
right,
who had very severe short-term memory loss and contributed a lot to science because of the severity and sort of purity of the case. But luckily, that's not the sort of case we're talking about now. We're talking more about a vindication where you really came out ahead.
Much better.
Right?
Yeah, seizures are gone. Now, they knew that they're going to take a part of my brain, so something's going to be missing. But they do now. They're more advanced in mapping your brain. So they spend a couple hours mapping my brain to see what are we taking out and what will be there. What will be there. And because they were mapping the left brain, they knew they were going to take out some parts of memory. And my main thing is remembering students' names. I had to look at your name a few times before I came over here, which is interesting part of the brain to take out. But it's a minor loss in terms of what I've gotten back.
Right.
You know, my love of life, certainly not having the seizures. There's just the intensity of, and as much as I can do in a day of in the past, what I couldn't do in a day because of the seizures.
Right. So in 2001, I believe, when
right.
you got the surgery, how was your brain mapped? Was it with just EEG or was it with MRI?
No, they kept waking me up. So I didn't realize this. So what they were doing is they can have a type of anesthetism where you put just a piece of your brain to sleep.
Hmm.
So they're going through, they're waking me up, and then they're asking me questions. What's the date? Who's the president? And they wanted to know if I could speak. They showed me objects, wanted to make sure I knew what they were. Then they would tell me things and wanted to make sure that my short-term memory had them. So then when they saw that all those parts of the brain were doing good. Then they looked at the part where they were going to remove and see exactly what was there. And they thought that what was in that piece, they also saw was present in the right lobe that could pick up the pieces when this part was removed. So I'm more artistic and more love music now since the surgery because my right lobe is rising to the occasion, so which is interesting. And that's
sense of gain.
Yeah, that you know, you got that plasticity in the brain, the part that connects both lobes. When one lobe gets weak, the other lobe can rise to the occasion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering just, and this is somewhat of trivial detail, but you were being woken up during this procedure just to figure out how different processes were being manifested in the brain. It sounds somewhat unwelcome. Like, hey, if you're going to operate on me, just operate on me.
Just do it. Get it over with, please. Yeah.
Right, but they had to map your brain. All right, so they're asking you things. They're showing you pictures. But were you inside a machine, or did you just have a cap on, or do you remember that?
What I remember, I was laying – I know I was on my right side. Much of the time, because that's when they're doing a lot of the mapping. And then, of course, I had to flip over while they mapped this. So I'd be laying on my side, so I couldn't see the whole room when they were doing it. But I do remember seeing a guy's face that was asking the questions. So I constantly remember the questions. I constantly remember seeing the objects. And so I remember too much of it. Then I do remember when they found the Broca. They asked me who I was, and I couldn't answer. I knew the answer, but I couldn't say it.
Hmm.
They asked me the date. I couldn't say it. So they found the date. They says, okay, we got the Broca. We're ready to go. That was the last step. Then I knew surgery was going to start. So they had a hard time finding the Broca. They had to look for a while for that. So I remember a lot of it, but many times vague because they still had some anesthetic going in me.
Hmm. Well, there are a couple elements of your story that are interesting that say something about medicine and say something about diagnosis. There's this point in 1991 where you finally had what was a more well-documented type of seizure, you know, a tonic-clonic grand mal seizure,
right,
where you went fully unconscious and were convulsing. That's what was typically considered epilepsy. It's what was in the books at the time,
right,
and more well understood, even though it's not the only type of epilepsy symptom or part of the whole syndrome. So you had something very similar, I assume, in 1989 as you had in 1992. And yet there was this big shift because all of a sudden you had been labeled and you were given medications. And I want to just explore what the differences were there, because it seems like you actually coped in a pretty tough and stoic way before the diagnosis, and that there were some benefits to that. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I do. I agree with that. I do remember when you're hit with a label like epilepsy. I remember myself when I knew I was an epileptic, what that felt like. Maybe restrictions in driving. What does that mean? I could have a seizure today and fall and pass out, or even a minor seizure where I might not be able to understand what my students are saying. When I was in denial, when I didn't know they were seizures, it was a minor inconvenience. And I remember my neurologist saying, Karen, I have never had a patient that had 30 to 90 seizures a month. And I've never had a patient that got a PhD. How did you do that? I was in denial. You know, so I just said, it's a minor thing. I can't think now for an hour. I'll go back to work in an hour and do the studying. So there was part of that, you know, not knowing it was a disability.
Yeah.
For the benefits.
I'm trying to figure out if your epilepsy somehow got naturally worse over time.
Oh,
or,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It still would have, which is probably what convinced me to have the surgery. Mm. The seizures were getting, he didn't think more frequent, but worse. So he thought that the focal point was having a lot of seizures, because you have the brain waves, and mine just were going right. That's a seizure. But I was having a lot of them, but they were getting worse, more intense. So he said, you might end up with memory loss in the future. And so that's with some of the stuff. I said, yeah, you're right, because these seizures are worse now than when I first. And, of course, I started having the grand mal ones. I didn't have the grand mal at all as a kid. Just a couple partials, then the partials became more common in college. Mm-hmm. Then in graduate school, it turned into a grand mal. And then the seizures, minors became more severe. So I thought, I better stop this now. While it's still healthy enough where they know where it is and they can take it out.
Right. Sounds like you made a good choice.
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah.
All right, so there's some natural progression in your brain that was changing your epilepsy, but it's so interesting just to keep on thinking about the medications and what they were doing for you, because they had pretty nasty side effects,
oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is your understanding that they essentially, you just didn't respond to them, or did you notice some kind of mitigating effect?
Both. I think probably I had I think I have what's called a low threshold, meaning I would have a lot of seizures every month, where you might have a seizure if you had a infection in your high fever and infection, you might have a seizure. I had a lot of seizures, so I had a low threshold. The medications prevented the grand mal. So I wasn't having grand mal, and it took away a lot of the very minor seizures, but I still had some of the bad partials. So the meds were helping, so I had enough insight that I took the meds even though it had horrible side effects. I was nauseous all the time, had double vision, even threw up when I was getting used to one of the meds. But I took them because I knew I wanted to control the grand mal. But then at the end, I was topping out on three meds when they said, let's pursue surgery and see if we can get the focal point out.
Right. When you were coping before diagnosis, and maybe when it was a little easier to cope, there are a couple of things. You didn't have the stigma of a label, but you were trying to operate normally as much as possible, and that, I think, would lead a listener to some questions like, did you drop things or did you have trouble driving? Give us some sense of some of the difficulties you encountered that at the time maybe you didn't know how to explain.
This one example, this was the year before I was diagnosed. I was driving from Austin, Texas up to Dallas. What happens when you hit South Dallas is the freeway splits. You go east into Dallas and west into Fort Worth. I had one of the partials right then, which I would just call the feeling, and I took the wrong way. I ended up going west into Fort Worth. So all of a sudden, here I am alert on the road. Why did I take this into west? Why am I going into Fort Worth instead of Dallas? So those were the things that happened. I do remember dropping things at times, wondering why I had, and so I think I just had a couple partials in terms of that. But let's just put it this way, and I did end up, this was after I was diagnosed, I did wreck my car. I had a partial seizure driving home from school. I remember the seizure starting. That's the last thing I remember. My car went up against a tree. I'm glad it didn't hurt anybody else. I ruined the car, and I knew then you cannot drive with partials. That's the problem. They don't know how to take away driving restrictions with partials. So I took it away from myself because I ruined the car, and I was glad I didn't hurt anybody else.
Right.
So that's when the partials were getting worse. So I knew I needed an alternative here because, yeah, you know, so I had to stop driving.
Yeah, let's think about partials a little more, because I think there's some distinction between simple and complex and being more conscious versus less conscious. So it sounds like most of the partials you had up to 1991, starting in your 20s, going up to your early 30s, were somewhat disabling. Like, you might have an impairment in thinking or language, somewhat sense of nauseousness and nervousness and unpleasant things, but you were still conscious or partially conscious most of the time, right?
Right. I still went to all classes, did all the schoolwork. I don't remember having memory lapses. I just remember those moments of nausea and,
So it's almost as if you had just some kind of recurrent full body, like stomach flu or something.
Well, it was a feeling, because it would make me feel strange, and I would get old memories. So all of a sudden, I'd be sitting there studying, and all of a sudden, I'd get memories of being a kid. That's called deja vu, which is common with partial seizures. But though they were very minor, they didn't last very long, and I recovered immediately. As the partials got worse, they were lasting like up to a minute, and then my recovery might take 1 to 6 hours.
Right, and there's a name for that recovery, right? The post-ictal stage,
very good, yeah. So that's when the seizures were getting worse. I had more postictal, and that's as I was aging, so to speak.
Well, just reflecting sort of to cap this off, is there anything you'd say to others who've struggled with epilepsy or with any other sort of medical diagnosis that's taken them by surprise, something you've learned that you'd want to share with them?
Well, I have hope. And certainly I think this is a good time for medicine, not for all types. But it's exciting that there were doctors that really – now, not all places could do the type of surgery. I was over at UNC, and they did not do my type of brain surgery, so they referred me to Duke. So certainly when I first went to doctors, they were just general practitioners. They wouldn't know what an epilepsy or a seizure was. But it's exciting. I just happened to be here in North Carolina, right close to Duke, which is one of the few hospitals that ace in brain surgery for epilepsy. But it's an exciting time for those with challenges. I think we now have more acceptance with people with disabilities. Maybe it's because those of us with disabilities don't hide as much as we did a generation or two ago. So we're finding, you know, more in terms of that. So it's an exciting time, not for all, but for lots.
Right. Well, it sounds like a good way to end. Dr. Karen Glum, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed.